WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
We lost writer Michael Darris on Friday. Police say he apparently committed suicide by suffocating himself with a plastic bag. He was 52. Darris had written about Native Americans in his fiction and nonfiction. He was part Native American, a member of the Modoc tribe, and founded the Native American Studies program at Dartmouth. Darris and his wife, writer Louise Erdrich, had closely collaborated on their books, but they were reportedly divorcing when he died. Before they married, Darris became one of the first bachelors allowed to adopt a child. His son Reynold, who he later called Adam in a book, was born on a Sioux reservation to an alcoholic mother. Later, Darris learned his son had fetal alcohol syndrome. His book about the syndrome, The Broken Cord, won a National Book Critics Circle Award and was adapted into a telemovie. In 1992, Michael Darris told me about growing up on a reservation and some of the misguided actions taken by white charity groups.
We used to be the beneficiary of people in Cleveland who would donate money and clothing, and this would be distributed. And one of the perks that they got for donating money and clothing is that they got to name somebody, and so we would get named.
Oh, gee.
And I must say, I once had the name Aloysius, which
oh, no.
Which I'm sure was the name of a parish that someone of very good will. And the other thing is people used to donate, I've never seen them since, undershirts with buttons on the shoulders. Whenever I think of that whole process, I think of buttons on the shoulders.
So did you grow up both liking and also both appreciating but really resenting the people from outside who were trying to help?
You know, it's hard to say. You know, when you live within the context of an overall situation, you don't analyze it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of the life that goes on. I by no means mean to disparage or discourage people who are generous. I would ask them to send both a left and a right shoe. You know, I mean, that is nice. Not one shoe doesn't do a lot of good. But I just wrote a long essay about the issue of how deluged we Americans are on a daily basis with good causes through the mail.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, each one carefully packaged by a professional marketer, and each one quite worthy. And you get to the point where you think that nothing you can do can make a difference, and if you've given $10 last year and it didn't solve the problem, well, goodbye to that charity. When in fact, I think there are many things in this world that require an ongoing commitment without the expectation that it's going to succeed.
In 1989, after the publication of The Broken Cord, Michael Darris told me why he wanted to adopt a child while he was 26 and still single.
I come from a long line of single parents who happen to be women, but my mother and her mother and her mother all had been widowed early and had raised children, I hope successfully, without being a double-parent family. So that was my role model. It wasn't that I self-consciously planned to be a single parent, but rather that I got to a point in my life where I really wanted children. And the way to get children, if I wasn't married and I was a male, was to adopt.
Well, the child who you were offered was Adam, who you adopted. He was 3 at the time, and he was diagnosed as mentally retarded. Did you have any reservations about taking on the responsibilities of a retarded child?
I didn't believe the diagnosis. I was, as you say, in my early 20s. This was just after the 1960s. It was a period of time, I think, when people of my generation were ultimately very optimistic, and also a period of time where to believe anything other than nurture determined the outcome of a child was considered quite bad taste and perhaps even politically wrong. I certainly was in that camp. I believed that nurture was everything, and when I heard that my son was young for his age, which was the euphemism for mildly retarded, I actually looked upon that as a good thing because I figured he would be more my own child being young. It would be almost as if I were adopting him when he was 1.5 or 2 rather than 3.
Well, what led you to finding out about fetal alcohol syndrome was your son's seizures. This wasn't a part of what was expected when your son was diagnosed as mildly retarded. And the seizures led you to a series of doctors who also didn't say anything about fetal alcohol syndrome. You found out about it by through a drug rehabilitation center.
It was almost 11 years after the adoption had been finalized. There had accumulated a series of discrete symptoms, both in terms of my son's physical problems, everything from poor hearing and eyesight and too many teeth in his mouth, curvature of the spine, poor balance, you name it, a whole range of things that had to do with the development of his bone structure and major organs, and then a whole series of behavioral problems as well. The fact that he found it very hard to learn new things. It took me, I would say 2 years to teach him to tie his shoes. It took until he was almost 8 before he was toilet trained. Each of these things I explained to myself as simply catching up, that he had been traumatized, that he was young for his age, and that there would be a breakthrough and everything would fall into place by the time he was 21. He would be able to do all these things. But nevertheless, because he was hyperactive in school, I did see a number of counselors, neurologists, psychologists, etc., all of whom had flashed warning signs, but nobody had a name to put to this collection of symptoms, which seemed unlike anything that was easily labeled. Then in 1981, I was doing some consulting work for the Bush Foundation on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota, and I was at a sort of halfway house for teenage kids who had no place else to go, and there was a group came in who reminded me in subtle and yet unmistakable ways of my son, in their demeanor and how they interacted with each other and how they watched television and how they stood and so forth. I said to the counselor, "Who are they and what's their story?" And he said to me, "They're FAS." In the world of Indian affairs, there's a zillion acronyms, and I thought this was just another one, so I asked him what that was, and he said fetal alcohol syndrome, and then described the symptoms of fetal alcohol syndrome, and it was as if he were describing my son, though he had never met him, and it just blew me away.
Michael Darris's book, The Broken Cord, about his son with fetal alcohol syndrome, was made into a TV movie. During the production, that son was hit by a car and killed. I talked with Michael Darris in 1992, about a year after the accident. Last month was the first anniversary of the death of your son, Abel. Did you have some kind of ritual for marking the anniversary of the death? Did you feel the need and the usefulness of something like that?
We planted a tree in a place that he loved, and we, with a very small group of people, talked about our complicated memories of him. And it isn't a kind of ritual that you can find in a book or anything else, but it was healing. He was a very vivid person, and I think that is why the book was written, because he demanded attention. He demanded indignation, because even with all of his exasperating qualities, of which there were many, and I don't want to gloss over those, there was within Abel a gentleness and a kindness and a patience that will instruct many of us forever. And I think it is the frustration that those qualities couldn't be available to the world in the way that they should have been that convinced Louise and me to write about our experience and encourage Abel to write the last chapter, which he did, and make a contribution by example that he couldn't make through action. And you know, I think in the final analysis, we're enormously proud of him.
You know, you use the expression complicated memories. your complicated memories of your son. I think many people feel that to honor the dead, you should kind of forget the things they did that caused you pain and only remember the good things. And it sounds to me like what you want to do is remember your son in his full complexity and as honestly as possible.
Well, that's true. And when I did field work in Alaska about 20 years ago, I remember very well the traditional funerals of the Athabascan Dena'ina people that I lived with and whose language I learned. And the commemoration service, which generally took place a year after the death, was three parts. On the first day, you grieved very dramatically and cried and wept. The second day, you told brave stories about what the person had done, admirable things. And the third day, when everybody was really exhausted and worn out with the process, everybody told the funniest story that they ever remembered about the deceased person. And there was a relief in the laughter that came. And after that, people ate and slept. And it put a kind of closure to the experience in remembering that complexity.
Michael Doris recorded in 1992. He died Friday at the age of 52, an apparent suicide. His latest book, the novel Cloud Chamber, was published earlier this year. This is Fresh Air.